Welcome to Conversations with the Masters with your host, Master Certified Coach Mary Allen. This special interview series is designed to enlighten and empower you by bringing you the best-selling authors, speakers, and organizations of our time. So get ready to listen not only with your ears and mind, but with your entire being. And now, here's your host, Mary Allen.
We've got Cheryl Richardson here on the line, and this is the Conversations with the Masters call. And I am Mary Cole. I'm a professional life coach, author of The Power of Inner Choice, and your host of the Conversations with the Masters series. And for the previous 40 years, I actually have been known as Mary Allen, but I was just recently married here on May 5th. So if everyone can try and remember Mary Cole, this is the first time I've actually introduced myself, I think, to such a large group of people with my new name.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a little bit odd, you know. But I do want to let everyone on the call today know that it will be recorded, so you can go back and you can listen to this call again. You can refer other friends to listen. If you've pre-registered for the call, you'll be receiving a follow-up email with information about how you can access the call. And we'll also be posting the three lucky prize winners that we'll announce later in the call who will be receiving the Grace gift pack. And you'll get updates on other future calls that we'll be doing as well. So I really appreciate everyone for spreading the word about these great opportunities to really get a chance to connect live and in person with some really, really special guests. And I do just want to make a note that part of the criteria for me even selecting a guest, usually they are somebody that has already impacted thousands of lives through their best-selling books and speaking. But when I select a guest, too, it's also somebody that has really played a significant role in my own transformation and my own life. And that's definitely true with my guest today, with Cheryl. And Cheryl, I don't even know if you know this, but I first heard you actually speak in Scottsdale, Arizona at my very first International Coach Federation conference back in 1998.
Oh, long time ago.
A long time ago. And you were talking about just the basics of building a coaching practice, and it was the conference I decided to become a coach myself. And then I have gone on to see you. Your first book came out in, I think, 1999, Take Time for Your Life?
That's right.
And then I think a year or so later, I saw you as a staple on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and I was living in California, and they had the reruns on at 12:30 at night, so I would stay up late on the days that I knew you were on to just capture these extra insights about coaching and see how you interacted with the tough cases and all of the people that were coming on the Oprah Winfrey Show for some transformation. But you've really been somebody who's been a role model for me in my coaching practice and certainly influenced my writing my own book and your standards of excellence. And just I really admire how you've made a huge impact in the world and how you've really stayed authentically grounded in that whole process.
Thank you a lot. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, and for those people that aren't familiar with Cheryl, I'm just going to brag on you for a few minutes here. So Cheryl Richardson is author of 4 best-selling books, Take Time for Your Life, Life Makeovers, Stand Up for Your Life, and The Unmistakable Touch of Grace, which I just finished reading and is fabulous. Cheryl was the first president of the International Coach Federation and holds one of the very first Master Certified Coach credentials, which there aren't that many of them out there. That's a very high credential in our industry. Cheryl speaks all over the country. She's done several television projects, including 2 PBS specials, a series on the Oxygen Network, and a series for the Oprah Winfrey Show. And I think really well known for her expertise in work-life balance. And what I love is seeing the transition, how your latest book really even goes on the deeper spiritual side of our life. I'm talking about this force called grace. So we'll get into that today as we've got many great subjects we'll get to touch upon. And I'm excited, too, that for the other coach coaches and authors and aspiring speakers on the call. We'll take some time towards the end and kind of find out a little bit more about your journey as a coach, an author, and a speaker. So I'm excited that you're here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, and just as a little side note trivia, I've always felt as a kindred spirit since we're in the same coaching profession, but also that my mother is a Richardson, and as all my cousins. So there's, I don't know that we're related, but every time I receive Richardson, it always makes me reminds me of you as well. So let's get started. So many questions, but let's start with where you started and take time for your life and your very first book. So tell us about what really the key message from that book is, Take Time for Your Life.
Well, Take Time for Your Life is really focused on getting a handle on our outer lives. And, of course, Take Time was the first book I wrote as a coach, and it really profiled the journey that I would take clients on. And, you know, I would say that one of the most important things I learned as a coach early on is that it's very difficult to support people in developing a strong inner life, a strong connection to their spiritual core, let's say, to really even do the kind of inner work that's necessary to lead a truly rich and satisfying life when your outer life is really crazy and busy and overwhelming. And so I started from the outside in. One of the most profound things I learned as a coach and working with clients, it sounds so simple, but it's really important, was that I kind of say it this way. When I was working with an individual client, I always started by having them write a life story, having them identify three goals that they wanted to accomplish in the first 90 days of working together, and then 10 specific items that were draining their energy. And I did that, first of all, because it really gave me a quick snapshot into what was going on in that client's current life and where they came from. And certainly that wasn't quick. The life stories were often pretty involved. Sometimes they weren't, but it really gave me it was a very quick way to get a sense of who the client was. And the profound thing was that I discovered that once I had an idea of what the client's goals were, I actually put those aside and focused on eliminating the energy drains. And if you could imagine yourself sitting right where you're sitting right now and maybe 10 feet in front of you, or let's say 50 feet in front of you, imagine that the goals, the three primary goals that you might have for your life right now exist 50 feet away. Well, most of us will set the goal, you know, put it in writing, create a plan of action, and then start moving toward that goal. So imagine yourself walking toward those three goals that are 50 feet away. What I discovered in my work with clients and what I really tried to capture in the process and Take Time for Your Life was that rather than create the action plan and walk toward your goals, by eliminating the obstacles, eliminating the things that were draining a client's energy, it was as if I was just removing the blocks between them and those goals that were 50 feet away, and those goals naturally started to move toward them. Now, sometimes the goals just kind of fell off the track because the reality was that the goals that they were setting were in reaction to what was draining their energy. And so some of them just fell by the wayside. Often what would happen is as we started to handle the little things, whether it's, you know, getting the oil change that you've been meaning to get in your car, cleaning out the garage, creating a soul-nurturing environment, eliminating clutter, which is a big thing, handling some draining relationships, getting your finances in order, whatever the sort of basics of life were, as we started to handle those things, not only did the goals start to move toward them, but a life that was far beyond what either one of us could have imagined for the client began to unfold before that client. And so it's just really interesting to me how when we handle the stuff that's the stuff, quote, stuff in our life, and we start to eliminate the things that are draining our energy, we actually draw towards us a far greater life, and very often a life that's far beyond what we could have imagined at the time that we were so overwhelmed with the energy drains in our life. So the basic message of Take Time for Your Life is, I'll tell you what it is, and the short form is grow up. Grow up. Take responsibility for the basics of your life, your finances, your health, your relationships, your environment. dedicate, I say right in the book, right up front, it's a 1 to 3 year process that will completely transform the way you live your life. It's not a quick fix. There's no such thing as a quick fix. But the great thing is that you experience relief immediately. You start to feel a sense of spaciousness in your life, both emotionally and physically. You start to feel freed up, and you start to really see great things show up in your life. So that's kind of the message of Take Time in a Nutshell. And I will say, you know, at this point in my career, I really, and in my life, I just see myself as a vehicle. You know, my job is to constantly be raising my own level of consciousness and to walk my talk, which is such an overused phrase and yet so important. The more I do that, the more I raise my own level of consciousness, the more effective a vehicle I can be. And I'm just a vehicle. And with Take Time for Your Life, there is something, it's funny, my first book and my last book, The Unmistakable Touch of Grace, are such great examples of books where I got out of the way and allowed myself to just be used by a higher force, because those two books have changed people's lives in such dramatic ways just by reading it. And I'm telling you, I'm not that good of a coach or a writer to make those kind of dramatic transformations for people happen out of a book. It's really otherworldly. And I think it's about energy, and I think it's about really recognizing that we have so much more power in our life than we realize. And if we just handle the basics, you know, a pretty magical life begins to unfold.
Yep, I completely agree. It's something I continue to work on with my clients as well, and I'm always blown away at the impact when we sometimes refer to them as toleration, and when we clean up those tolerations, the ripple effects really create so much more energy. And I agree, it's well worth that 1 to 3 year investment, and starting with getting all the outer stuff out of the way. I love how you describe that. Well, and so people also, one of your big themes is work, you know, work-life balance, and so many people struggle with that. And so it's always a big question, you know, is balance really possible? You know, is change really possible?
Yeah, I mean, certainly change is absolutely really possible, very much possible. And over the last few years, there's a talk that I started giving, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years ago, called The Myth of a Balanced Life.
Mm.
And especially for women, I find that, you know, when I say to audiences, and this is true for men too, but especially for women, when I say to audiences, you know what, there's no such thing as a balanced life. Like, it doesn't exist. You feel a collective sigh of relief in the room. Because for a lot of us, especially if you're an overachiever, when you hear about a balanced life, you think about it, like, it becomes one more major piece of work to somehow balance out all the different areas of your life. Instead, I really just think of it as a high-quality life. And a high-quality life is a life that allows you to focus your time and energy on your top priorities at this time. The truth is, in life, our priorities shift all the time. If you're on this call and you have a child and the child's sick, that's your priority right now. If all of a sudden you've lost your job and you need to bring an income in, your priority becomes your job search process. And the trick of having a life that feels satisfying and fulfilling is first and foremost about being able to control, to a certain extent, how you expend your time and energy. So, you know, when I'm writing a book, it consumes my world. Do I have a world outside of writing? Of course I do. But it takes up a big part of my life. So somebody looking at my life would say, wow, her life's out of balance. She's spending 70% of her time writing and 30% on everything else. But the reality is that 30% is devoted, consistent time. I eliminate a lot of, extra stuff that I don't need to be involved in. And I spend time with my husband, who's a top priority in my life. But at that time, my biggest priority is getting the book written, or when I'm touring for a book. You know, when you go out on tour, it's like training for a marathon, and, you know, that becomes the priority. If you're, suddenly you're diagnosed with an illness, your physical health may very well become a priority. So if you're able to spend your time and energy on the things that are most important to you at this time, that's what starts to feel like a sane life to you. It doesn't mean that sometimes things don't feel out of balance, even in that regard, because, you know, we're human, and we're all of us are still, you know, it's so fascinating to me. We live in a world of high-tech with the most extraordinary high-tech abilities, and yet the human nervous system was never, ever, ever set up to handle the pace with which we live now, which is why most people feel so burdened and overwhelmed. It's like we're trying to race in the Indy 500 with an old jalopy, or let's maybe not call it an old jalopy, but you know, we're trying to race in the Indy 500 with an outdated model that's never been reworked for the kind of race that we're living in now, and that really requires us to operate, to upgrade our inner operating system and to begin to manage ourselves instead of buying into the illusion that you can somehow manage time. We can't do that. And so there's creating a life that honors your priorities is absolutely possible, but here's the truth. You have to give up stuff. I mean, in my experience as a coach, 99% of the people who have come to me, 99% of the audience members I deal with, anyone I deal with, people in the media or whatever, when they say to me, my life is so overwhelming, can you help me to get better organized, or can you help me to manage my time, the first thing I say is no. The second thing I say is, you know, let's look at what you need to take off your plate, because very rarely do I meet somebody who doesn't have enough on their plate. It's usually that they have too much, and it's a question of saying no and making space.
How do you help somebody decide what to take off their plate?
We just, you know, the simple question of, you know, tell me the top 10 things that are draining your energy, as silly as it's, as simple as it sounds, is the place that I begin. And I make sure that they are 10 specific tangible items, that they're not, well, my house looks like a bomb went off, you know, in it. That's a huge item. We'd then break it down to, okay, let's look more specifically at what are some of the items in that, in your house. Like, how can we break it down? That's where I begin, because the first thing you want to do is help a client to free up their energy. Or the first thing you want to do as the person involved is to get some space, get some emotional, mental, physical space, and to free up some of your energy. So we start by looking at what are some of the simple little things that, you know, there's three ways to handle the energy drains. You either hire somebody else to do it, or barter with somebody, or ask for a favor, or whatever. You get rid of it altogether, and that's a viable option a lot of times. You just say, you know what, I'm not going to take on that extra project. I can't do it. Or you do it yourself, and that needs to be reserved for only those things that you absolutely have to do. Like, only you can go to the doctors and get a checkup. Now, you can't send someone else to do it. It would be kind of great if you could send someone else to the dentist. I'm still working on that one.
That would be really great. That would
be very great. But there's certain things that only you can do. So we start with, what are the 10 items? Let's give you an experience of relief, of what it's like to have more freedom and more energy, and then we kind of go from there.
So that's something everyone on this call could be doing, is list out top 10 energy drains and start going to work on it right away.
Yeah, what you want to do to make it fun and to put accountability in place is you want to get, you know, I always recommend get another person who feels like they've got energy drains in their life, and pretty much everybody does, and make it a game. Decide that the two of you over the next 30 days are going to make it a priority, and share with each other the 10 items that you've chosen to work on, and then get to work on them together. You know, and decide on how you're going to celebrate at the end of 30 days when you have the 10 energy drains completed.
Such a great idea, and something, and so doable.
Yes, very much so.
So doable. Well, and you also talk about extreme self-care.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about what that is.
Well, the phrase extreme self-care was introduced to me by Thomas Leonard, who was my very first coach, and who was really the epitome of extreme self-care. To an insane degree at times, as a matter of fact. I mean, I remember when I first met Thomas, you know, and began working with him and got to know him, he had such high standards that I could not even imagine living that way. I mean, he extreme self-care, he was very smart in choosing the word extreme, because it really got your attention, and I found that over the years, it really does get people's attention when you talk about extreme self-care. And when he said extreme, he meant it. I mean, you know, I'm trying to think of some specific examples with him, but, you know, he was very particular about how he spent his time, who he would speak with, how long he would speak to people, very efficient, you know, efficiency-oriented. And, you know, if somebody drained his energy, they would not exist in his life. It just wasn't an option to interact with him. Now, those seemed like outrageously strong boundaries to me, but at the time that I met him, you know, I didn't have a lot of really good boundaries. You know, instead what was happening was that I was, you know, just basically doing what everybody else wanted me to do and complaining about not having a life of my own. So working with somebody who was at such the opposite extreme as to where I was actually a real benefit, because it helped pull me to the center, which is, you know, how a lot of us grow. Many of us will go from one extreme to another and then find a center point. And so the phrase extreme self-care became very important to me. It became a standard that I aspired to live up to and sort of continuously raised the bar in myself. And it's a phrase that I've continued to use in my work. It's a phrase that really guides my life. I'm so grateful to him for having introduced me to that concept. It's a phrase we incorporate in our company here. You know, a lot of the decisions we make in the company are made with the idea of, you know, will this honor your extreme self-care? For example, when I started doing retreats at Miraval, that came directly out of the standard of extreme self-care, when at one point I said to my staff, you know what, if I'm going to go teach, I want to go someplace beautiful, because beauty is a very high value to me. Nature is extremely important to me. I want to go someplace that's beautiful, where I can eat healthy food, where I can exercise consistently and get body work, which was also a very, not a luxury, but a necessity to me. And I chose Miraval out of a whole bunch of places because it fit the concept of extreme self-care. We now have an online web store, an e-commerce store called myextremeselfcare.com. And we also, there, I not only am I making the kinds of products and tools and the tools that I create to help people practice extreme self-care, but also the products that I use in my own life to practice extreme self-care. Because, once again, it's a driving force behind my company. It's a standard not only that I aspire to live by, but that I also want for other people as well. So it's a really important, important concept in my life and in the lives of the people I write for and speak to.
Really, self-care is just really making sure that you're taken care of in every way.
And the reason for that is this, that when we care more deeply for ourselves, when we have high standards for how we live, we naturally begin to care for others in an even better way. You know, first of all, we're able to care for others in a better way. And it, as a very simple example of that, I can remember coaching CEOs and working with them to practice extreme self-care in their own lives, which meant maybe, you know, leaving the office at 5 and having dinner with their family, or, you know, taking time for vacation without email or phones, you know, really having good quality time. And eventually, as we start to take better care of ourselves, we raise our level of consciousness and we care more about our families, the community in which we live, the state, the country, the world in which we live. So that suddenly a CEO who never recycled in his life suddenly starts to care about what he's putting into the earth, because he's caring about what he's putting into his body. And suddenly he couldn't not think of recycling. You know, suddenly they're involved in a community recycling project, because that's how our own practice of self-care begins to extend out into the world. And, of course, that's my greater mission, is to really support people in raising their level of consciousness so that how they behave in the world is far greater than where they started. I mean, that's the most profound work we do as coaches, really, is to help people raise their level of consciousness. They become better people. We become better citizens of the world. And we all benefit.
I completely agree, and that's definitely a mission that I share as well. It's all about just raising that awareness, raising the consciousness, and the ripple effect is unbelievable. Well, some people, though, have said, well, you know, what's really the difference between self-care and selfishness? And even, you know, there was I know when you first went on Oprah, it was such a novel concept to take care of yourself that, you know, people called it almost selfish. So what's really the distinction there?
Yeah, you know, at this point, it's so funny. I remember one time I was doing, I think it might have been either the Today Show or Good Morning America, one of them, and I tell this story about, I remember the host said to me, I forget who it was, but I remember they said to me, you know, so you talk about this self-care, I think this was after Life Makeovers came out, you talk about this whole concept of self-care, but aren't you just really asking people to be selfish? You know, they were trying to sort of be controversial, and I remember looking right at the host, and I said, yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. And then I didn't say anything, which completely threw them, because they weren't expecting that response. But, you know, I am so over I feel like it's an old conversation now for us to be so wrapped up in selfishness. Because here's what I know. I know that I am more generous today than I've ever been in my whole life as a result of taking really good care of myself in a number of ways, with my time, my energy, my money, because I'm capable of doing that. Every person I've ever worked with where I've taught them to be selfish, which means stop doing things out of guilt and obligation, that you're not doing it out of love and that's not in anyone's best interest. Pull back a bit. Yes, it means for some people, especially women, challenging them to take a six-month sabbatical from giving so that they can replenish their own energy. Because otherwise, what you end up with is a whole bunch of martyrs out there helping people, you know, living in this state of chronic slow-burn resentment that ultimately the people you're helping pay for,
right,
one way or another. So I feel like, and I feel like this is true, that we're sort of moving beyond that accusation of selfishness, because I'm clear about what the long-term intention is. And by the way, we're not talking years here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm clear that when you take somebody and you really support them in taking good care of themselves over 6 months or a year, let's say, to begin, they not only do they have more time and energy to give to others, but they bring far greater imagination and creativity and resources and emotional presence to that calling. And that's what we really want. I don't want you giving to me just because you want me to like you. I don't want you giving to me because you feel guilty. I want you giving to me from a full cup because you are so thrilled about your life and you are so grateful, deeply grateful for your life, that you want me to have what you have. You know, that's ultimately, as a matter of fact, I would go so far as to say that selfishness is when you chronically do things for other people in the hopes of getting something back, even though you call it something else. That's selfishness.
Right. Kind of the backhanded way of right, attempting to get your needs met and so forth.
Yeah, and unfortunately, if we look at the female population, for example, I still often laugh and say, you know, we haven't had the right to vote for very long. And for hundreds of years, women actually needed to manipulate in order to get their needs met. That's what saved our lives. But we carry on that behavior of overgiving in an effort to get needs met. And both men and women do this, by the way. But we carry on that behavior, and it doesn't serve anybody. So in the beginning, sometimes a person does need to will appear selfish as they kind of pull back and begin to take care of themselves. This is where having a coach is so helpful. This is where having, you know, a life makeover group. It's why I started the life makeover groups years ago, these free places where you can meet up with people in your community. Because when you start to practice this, you are going to get flack from people in your life. I got it. Other people are going to give it to you. And you need support around you so that you're able to stay with it and really, really support yourself and taking good care of yourself so that you can then serve others in a much better way.
Absolutely. Well, and so how would you describe the key message of the second book, Life Makeovers?
Life Makeovers was a direct result of my assistant at the time, Stacy Bryce, who's now the president of AssistYou.com. She trains virtual assistants. Been doing that for years. But Stacy was my very first assistant, my first virtual assistant.
Mm-hmm. I have one of those.
Yeah, and Stacy had been a former community leader for AOL, and she, when my first book came out, she really encouraged me to start an online newsletter. This was back before anybody was doing it. And I resisted and said, no one's going to read it. She said, trust me, do it anyway. She really pushed me, and I did. And I think I had 50 people subscribing to the newsletter at the time, and so every week I would just write about a topic of the week, very often related to what I was struggling with in my own life. And then I would issue a take action challenge to the reader, challenging them to do something very practical and specific to improve the quality of their life that week. Well, I continued, and 50 people grew to 500, then grew to 5,000. It's now over 50,000. And I have this online community where every week I continue to do the same thing. It's therapeutic for me. I mean, people write to me all the time saying, how can you keep doing this? You know, 6 years later, every week you produce this newsletter. And for the most part, they are new every week. And what happened was when Take Time for Your Life came out, I finished, I think, the second year of the online newsletters, and I looked at it and thought, God, you know, not only is this really great content, but I had so many people writing to me saying that they loved the weekly format. So we decided to put it into a book format and publish it. And this was before I ever did the Oprah show. And then I ended up doing the Oprah show shortly after. And Oprah loved the book. She loved Life Makeover. She loved the simple chapters, the stories, the weekly format of the book, and decided to continue on doing this Life Makeover series, Lifestyle Makeover series, which, you know, I could have never in a million years imagined would happen.
Wow.
And so Life Makeovers, what it did was it became a bridge between that and my third book, Stand Up for Your Life, in that it continued the outer work that I wrote about and Take Time for Your Life in a weekly format, but it also began challenging the reader to go inside and to start looking at some of the inner work that also needed to begin to happen in order to improve our lives. And then from there came Stand Up for Your Life, which was all about the inner work.
I'm making those inner changes.
You're listening to Conversations with the Masters with host Mary Allen. Mary Allen is a pioneer and leader in the coaching industry and author of the life-altering book, The Power of Inner Choice, 12 Weeks to Living a Life You Love, available everywhere. For more information on this and other coaching services designed to enlighten and empower you, visit lifecoachmary.com. And now, back to our conversation with the Masters.
Well, what do you see as being one of the most important interchanges that somebody can make?
Well, just the focus, first and foremost, on growing up emotionally, in stand-up, I talk about really getting clear about what your values are. I use the values test from Coach U, which was a wonderful test developed by Thomas early on. I sort of embellished it a bit to kind of strengthen it based on the work that I was doing with clients. But we start out with it, you know, identifying what your values are, and then really beginning to look at, you know, what probably one of the most important things that we can do is develop a strong relationship with ourselves in very practical ways, like journaling, like being part of a support group where you get to dialogue about yourself and what's going on in your life. Very often for people, it's also about engaging in some kind of emotional healing work, which could be working with a therapist or a counselor. As we develop a strong relationship with ourselves, we learn to come face-to-face with what I see as a chronic fear in this country, and that is the fear of hearing the question, who do you think you are? It's something I still grapple with myself today, probably always will for the rest of my life. You know, allowing good things to come into our life, allowing ourselves to be the best we can be, allowing ourselves to shine brightly. And the only way you overcome that fear of hearing the question, who do you think you are, is by being able to answer the question yourself, by really knowing who you are and developing such a strong relationship with yourself that you care more about what you think than what everybody else thinks. And that's a challenge for a lot of people. And once again, there's no quick fix about that. It happens over time. It happens with this consistent investment in those activities that allow you to get to know yourself on a deeper level. It really is. I remember one time I did an event with Bill Maher for a magazine, and as a matter of fact, I named one of the chapters in Life Makeovers over him, although he drives me crazy in a lot of ways. I remember when I was talking to him about the work I had done in Take Time, he said to me, oh, so, you know, I do that kind of work. I check under the hood. You know, I remember thinking, Bill, you could check a little more. But
check under the hood.
But yeah, his point was, you know, the phrase check under the hood, I mean, really that's what we're talking about. The inner work is about really, you know, going inside and getting to know who you are. And you know, it's not enough to just kind of write in a journal every now and then. It really is this this calling to answer the deeper questions like, who am I? Why am I here? What's the purpose of my life? How can I contribute? Where do I need to heal? What do I need to do in order to do that healing work? Those kinds of things. So it really is this ongoing commitment. And what I find is that the people who do that most effectively are the people who generally, when they take the values test, learning and growth come out as high values. Those are the people that are always going through life asking themselves, okay, how can I grow from this experience? Why might I have drawn this experience into my life? What can I learn from this? You know, what is this here to teach me? How is this a gift, even though it really sucks right now? How is this actually a gift for me?
That's interesting. That's, you know, because I've always wondered, you know, what really, you know, you see some so many people on the path of improving themselves and working with coaches and attending seminars and reading books and really authentically doing their work. And then there's another population that is sort of just going about their life in a fairly unconscious way. And I've always wondered kind of, you know, what do you see as the difference between somebody who ultimately responds to a wake-up call and those who don't?
Well, you know, first of all, it's timing. It's very interesting. The older I get, the more I appreciate the sort of spiritual process, the spiritual journey, the journey of growing. Somebody will get a wake-up call. They'll be diagnosed with an illness, let's say, and that will be the catalyst for transformation. All of a sudden, here's a good example. Suddenly, a spouse comes home and tells you they don't love you anymore and they want a divorce, and you're stunned, you're deeply hurt, you're terrified, and that person suddenly decides, you know, out of desperation, really, I'm going to go into therapy, I'm going to get the support I need, I'm going to begin to look at, you know, once I get over the shock of this, I'm going to use this grieving process to really help me understand what the heck happened. When someone decides to do that, it simply means that the timing was right for them. You know, on some level, they've chosen to wake up. Now, if someone else is faced with that situation and they say, oh, my God, this is horrible, and they want to either be steeped in the anger and the resentment of it, which is certainly understandable because it's a really painful thing to go through, or maybe they want to go out and just start drinking, or they immediately want to get into another relationship in the hopes that that will kind of ease the pain. If that person chooses unconsciousness, it's a choice, and it simply means that it's not their time yet. They're just not ready to wake up. And both people are on the same, are both on a spiritual path. It's just that, you know, one person's timing is different than another. I mean, the older I get, the longer I do this work, the far less judgmental I am. You know, for example, a lot of people will talk about victim mentality and how, you know, you've got to stop being a victim and you've got to take charge of your life. But the reality is that the whole victim mentality is a stop on the spiritual journey. You know, being at a point in your life where you feel like everything's happening to you and it's not fair and you feel like a victim to life is part of the journey. And the question is, you know, the hope is that you then move beyond that at some point. So it really is about timing. You can't make somebody get it quicker than they're ready to get it. And I guess I do feel, like I said, with more experience that I have, that, I mean, certainly as a coach, Thomas taught me early on, I remember he said to me early on, Cheryl, you know what, you're a very talented woman with great gifts to share. Don't waste your time trying to convert people who aren't ready to be converted. Like, don't do the conversion thing. You know, just show up, let somebody know who you are, let them know the kind of support that you can give them, and if they're interested, they'll come on board, and if not, bless them and walk away. And I, to this day, totally believe in that, because if someone's not ready to change, you shouldn't be trying to get them to change. It's inappropriate, it's arrogant, and it simply means that they're where they are in their spiritual path. You need to respect that. Be a power of example. You know, the 12-step programs have been saying that for years, and it works. Focus on your own life, and as a power of example, you will inspire others eventually when they're ready.
Wow. Well, and so this sort of kind of leads us into your most recent book, The Unmistakable Touch of Grace, which I so thoroughly enjoyed. And I have to say, as I was reading it, right when I got back from my honeymoon, we found out that my husband's father was terminally ill. And so we've been in Florida with him. And so I've been reading your book and just really finding that through kind of this really difficult time, it's really been an amazing resource to just be more connected to grace.
Well, thanks, Mary, and I'm sorry to hear that. And you know, and what's your father-in-law's first name?
It's also John.
John. Okay, good.
Because yeah.
I have a little prayer list I keep in my office. I'm just going to add them to the list.
Oh yeah, please do.
No,
please do.
And that's what people tell me, that The Unmistakable Touch of Grace is the perfect book for, and it is. You know what? I can tell you that it is a great book for when you're going through a difficult time in your life, whether it's loss, the surprise of something like that. It's a very personal book, of course, and it's a book that I had to write. It sort of closes the chapter of the work in that it's the deepest book in terms of the spiritual journey that we take. I mean, I tell the story of my own spiritual journey in the book, from unconsciousness to consciousness, and still the commitment for more, and, you know, for more consciousness. And what I really intended with that book, it's funny, what I started out, the intention I started with was a bit different than what it, I ended up with. The intention I hold for that book now is that it provides people with the comfort of knowing that we are never alone, that there is a power greater than us at work in the world. We might not understand it, we might not believe it. It exists anyway, and the influence of grace is available to each and every one of us at any moment in time. You just have to be awake enough to see it. And just like Take Time for Your Life, there's something very special about the book in that I feel like it has a life of its own and a purpose of its own. And it was a difficult book to write because I knew I needed to tell my own story and I needed to be honest about my own story, including, you know, what it was like on an emotional and spiritual level to go through the process of suddenly having a best-selling book, losing some of my privacy, you know, dealing with a crazy schedule, my involvement with September 11th, and, you know, all of the different events that have occurred in my life, and certainly the most amazing, miraculous things that have occurred in my life that so clearly were influences of grace, like meeting my husband, Michael.
I love that story.
Thank you. Thank you. I know there's thousands of women across America who, and all of you now, if you've not read the book, you can know that I met my husband through a personal ad, and the story is quite amazing. I won't tell it here because I won't do it justice. It's much better to read it.
It's much better to read it. But
it's much better in completion. But it's certainly, I get lots of emails from people saying, men and women saying, thank you. It provides me with hope.
Right. Well, and it's amazing, too, just the synchronicity of it, which is exactly how I met my husband as well, through just a moment of synchronicity that
A lot of times that's what happens. You know, when we open our lives to grace, the most significant events are usually clear indications that grace has had a hand in what's going on. You know, we see a clear indication that grace has had a hand in what's gone on.
And how do you really define grace?
I define grace as a benevolent force of energy that comes from the divine source. And how you define divine source is your business. For some people, that will be Jesus, God, the universe, spirit, a higher power, Buddha. And, you know, one of the greatest challenges I had with the book was writing a book that really respected all spiritual faiths and traditions. And I've certainly had an eclectic, although I was raised Catholic, I have very much an eclectic, a deep and rich eclectic spiritual practice and process now in my life. But that was pretty challenging, to be respectful and inclusive. I really wanted it to be inclusive. So grace is this benevolent force of energy. It comes from the divine source. It's available to every one of us. Like, the influence of grace is happening all the time. It's just that a lot of us are so busy running through life that we don't see it. We don't experience, or we write it off. You know, something will happen, an amazing, quote, coincidence will happen, and we think, you know, we'll stop for a moment and think, oh, my God, I can't believe that person just called me.
Right.
And I was just talking about them last night. Or I can't believe I just got this brochure about Sedona, which, please God, needs our prayers right now in terms of desperately needs rain. You know, I just got this brochure in the mail about Sedona when last night over dinner I was talking about moving there, you know. And we can be stunned, sort of spiritually stunned for a moment, and then we kind of blow it off and go on to the next thing. But so one of the things I strongly recommend right up front in the book is that people start to keep a grace journal and document some of these events. Because, you know, I can tell you, I get emails from people. I just got an email from a woman yesterday who gave me a whole list of amazing synchronistic events that occurred as she was reading Grace. And I read these things and I think, first of all, the fact that she's got it documented is going to be a great thing for her to turn to when she gets scared or feels faithless at a point in her life. Secondly, I'm inspired. You know, when I read it, I think it's great to see grace in action in other people's lives because it really inspires us to believe and to keep our eyes open.
You know, and so you talk that grace can show up in a whole variety of ways, in the coincidences that happen, even through our dreams, through people in our lives. And would you even say intuition is a form of grace showing up?
Sure. The intuitive hits that we get, or the nudges, or the, you know, I remember, I don't think I put this in the book, but I wrote a newsletter about this 1 week back when I was looking for a place to write The Unmistakable Touch of Grace, I live near the ocean in northern Massachusetts, and I really wanted a nice little quiet place by the ocean to write. And the inn, there was an inn on Plum Island that I wrote Stand Up For Your Life at, and it had since closed. It was under construction. And I was looking for a place to write, and I could not come up with a place. And every other day I would be driving downtown in our little downtown area, and I would drive by this hair salon of a woman I know. I used to go there. I had my nails done there once or twice, and I would drive by, and something inside me said, stop in and see her. Stop in and see her. She knows, you know, she lives down on Plum Island. She knows people. You should stop in and see her. And I just kept, you know, I write it off. Yeah, yeah, okay. Don't have time today. And the fourth time that I had this strong pull to stop in and see her, I called her. I actually went home and I called her. And I said to her, you know, I just wanted to let you know I'm looking for a place. And she said, oh, you know, it's so funny. You would call. My husband and I actually have a room right in the ocean, you know, overlooking the water because their house is right in the ocean. We have a room that we've been wanting to rent out. Why don't you come look at that? Maybe you could write there.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I thought, geez, hello, I teach this stuff. And, you know, I just listen to myself every now and then.
Right.
And I went down and saw the place, and it was interesting. I agreed to take it. And here's the interesting point about the story. I agreed to take it. So I got an intuitive hint. I finally acted on it. I took action. I agreed to take the place. And a week later, a beautiful little cottage right on the water with a whole wall of glass that looked out over the water became available as a result of me going down there and putting my energy down there. I just happened to be driving back, and I saw this little sign in a place I had never seen it before. And just for the heck of it, I called, and sure enough, the perfect place revealed itself, and I ended up not writing it there. But the point of that story is that, you know, grace does speak to us through our intuition, and when we pay attention and we take action, we've set in motion the energy of grace to support us. It's like we suddenly, it reveals itself and we're able to see the signs more clearly. We take action more consistently and then doors start to open, which is great.
And it can kind of just nudge us along from one step to the next to the next.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, and but this is a question that I get too. One of the chapters in my book is Spirit versus Ego, which is somewhat of a similar term as grace. But it's, you know, how do you distinguish that intuitive voice being grace or being more of an ego thought or more of you know, something that shouldn't be followed?
Well, you know, the way I would define ego in this regard is more like the personality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the word ego gets a bad rap because
I know,
you know,
it does.
We think about egotistical, but, you know, Carl Jung understood, you know, his description of the ego early on really captured that, you know, the ego part of us is the personality. It's the, you know, interestingly enough, the spiritual journey is about allowing the soul to express itself in the world so that, you know, it's about authenticity. So for a lot of us, as we're growing, especially when we're unconscious, often the personality, it's sort of like the clothes we step into to kind of look good in the world. And the goal over time is that who you are on the inside is reflected also on the outside so that you're congruent. You know, the person you are in the outer world is the same person you are when you're at home. That journey is deeply important. And so so there's nothing wrong with the personality. There's nothing wrong with the ego. It's kind of like that whole victim thing. If you start blaming somebody for being in that victim place, you just stunt their growth. You know, you don't support them in moving beyond it. It's the same thing with the personality. We want to be able to really help people. This is why I started with Take Time for Your Life, because when we start with the outer work, we begin to create authenticity in our life. We begin to create a scenario where when you're freed up from energy drains, when you're being honest about how you are living, when you are committed to living with integrity and doing the work to restore your integrity, then you're better able to bring the real you. You know, the real you comes to the surface, and that's what's reflected in the world, so that, you know, the soul, that who I am speaking right now is influenced by Cheryl, by my highest self, by my soul, and not my personality, not some mask that I wear or some, you know, outfit that I put on in order to impress you somehow. And I don't want to say that with, I don't want that to sound judgmental. I want to emphasize that that's a natural part of the growing process. I can remember a time distinctly where I would bend myself into a pretzel to do whatever you needed me to do to make sure that you would like me. You know, that's the personality operating. And as I began to do my own healing work, I could start to relax that a bit. Are there days I still do it? Absolutely. There are days where I overgive and I forget, oh, I'm trying to get a need met here. You know, let me meet that need myself instead of trying to get it met through you by overgiving and depleting my energy. I'm a human being as well, and it's a process over time, a process of growth, spiritual growth.
So basically, as we free up kind of the energy drains in our life, what you're saying is that, you know, what our actions become more of that direct reflection of the authentic self, which is more grace moving through us much more seamlessly, as opposed to maybe our personality kind of maybe fighting the force of grace.
Yep, well said.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and you used another word. I love the concept of a spiritual change agent. What is a spiritual change agent?
Spiritual change agent, they exist all around us, really. I mean, at this point in my life, I feel like every single encounter I have is a spiritual encounter, that there's a reason I'm supposed to meet somebody, even if it's just to receive a smile in an elevator or to give one. Spiritual change agent is someone who comes into your life to support you in raising your level of consciousness in some way. I write about it as, you know, as if life were a stage, or if your life were a giant play. You know, there were main characters, might be like your parents or your siblings, a spouse, people who play leading roles, and there were people who play supporting roles. It could be a therapist, it could be your accountant, it could be your doctor or the postman, postwoman. The point is that these people, when we start to recognize people for who they really are, we see that everyone we come in contact with has an opportunity to provide us with some kind of gift of awareness, of knowledge, self-knowledge, of a gift of a mirror reflecting back to us who we are and how we operate in the world. And interestingly enough, sometimes our most powerful and influential spiritual change agents are the people who cause us the most pain. So, for example, if you're going through a painful divorce and you've got a spouse who's been driving you crazy, that person may have come into your life to teach you how to stand up for yourself. Or the boss who consistently humiliated you in front of fellow employees and finally forced you to the point where you said, the hell with it, I'm out of here, and you leave that stupid job and you go out and you find something that's really fulfilling. In that way, that boss may have been a catalyst, a spiritual change agent that I would label a catalyst, somebody who really just forced you to make a move so that you could move toward doing something that's more aligned with your soul. So it's a really wonderful concept. You know, in The Unmistakable Touch of Grace, I write about my first editor, Marilyn Abraham, who, my only editor, I should say, a personal editor, who was really a midwife for me as a spiritual change agent. She was a midwife that helped me give birth to my writing career. And without her, I'm not sure, I certainly don't think I'd be in the same place I am today. I wouldn't be the kind of writer I am today. And we all have a midwife. We all have plenty of midwives, catalysts. A coach can be a beautiful midwife for a client, especially when it's the right match. And so a spiritual change agent is just that, such a gift in our life when we begin to see people in that through the lens of grace.
I completely agree. And, boy, I've had some, well, even difficult relationships can be. If it weren't for the last really, 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 really difficult relationship, I probably wouldn't be married to the man that I am. So,
yeah, I wouldn't be where I am today had I not had a lot of really tough things go on early on, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and not that I want to perpetuate that belief, but it's not that I'm saying to everyone, you better go out and look for tough things.
Yeah.
It
doesn't always have to come in the form of difficulty. It's really just, you know, anything that helps perpetuate consciousness. I love that definition.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, and so, since we're talking about grace, and we've also talked about more or less kind of taking charge of our lives in a way, we get to come back to that balance word, to the balance between taking charge of one's life, so the control and the taking action, versus maybe more or less surrendering to the force of grace. How would you describe that balance?
Yeah, how do you strike the balance? It's a good question and an important one that I get asked a lot. You know, The part of the book, I think it's page 141, because I read it over and over again.
I'm going to go
myself, where I wrote about surrender, is probably, you know, if we could all learn how to surrender, once we've done all that we can, we'd master a very powerful and probably most important spiritual skill, because when you surrender, you actually allow grace to work its magic in your life. And people will often say to me, well, you know, how do I know when to surrender? Well, you do all that you can in a given situation, and when you really believe you've done all that you can, you surrender. You put it in God's hands, you put it in higher power's hands, the universe's hands. So, for example, let's say that you're a parent. We just went through this. Every year we go through this in early spring. You know, all of the parents are waiting to see if their kids got accepted into the colleges they want to go to.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when the essays have been written and the applications filled out and sent in and all the phone calls have been made, there's nothing else you can do but surrender and trust that your child's highest good will reveal itself in the school that's chosen. You might not get what you want, but when you understand the concept of surrender, when you understand the concept of surrender and you value learning and spiritual growth, you recognize that you'll get what you need and you'll make the best of it. You know, you'll learn from the experience. So in that situation, it's a very practical example. The application's filled out, the check's sent in, you know, the phone calls are made or whatever. There's nothing else you can do but surrender. You're looking for a new job. You get a good resume done. You make sure you've had a recruiter or a good career coach look at it to make sure it's a great resume. You send it out. You get a job interview. You go to the interview. You've done the best that you can. And that person is not calling you back. You can't make them call you back. In that moment, you say, okay, I've done what I can, universe. Okay, higher power. Sent the resume, got the interview, brought my best self to the interview. It's in your hands. And I will trust the outcome. And I will respond accordingly, which means if the door is closed, I'm not going to bang my head against it. And if the door is open, like if I get another phone call and I'm invited to come back for a second interview, I'm going to go ahead and do that in an effort to continue walking the path and being responsive to the doors that open or the doors that close. So I remember one time I was giving a talk and this very sweet woman came up to me. I was talking about the unmistakable touch of grace, and this very sweet woman came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, how do you know when you've, she said it just like this, I've surrendered, you know, I have this situation in my life and I've done everything I could and I've surrendered it completely and, you know, when is it going to then start working? You know, how am I going to know that I've surrendered right and that it's going to start happening? And I just, you know, I had such empathy for her in that moment. You're not going to like what I'm about to tell you. If you've got angst about it, you're not surrendered.
Mm.
When we're truly surrendered, we truly give up the outcome to a higher order. There is no anxiousness. There is no pain. There is no desperation. You truly just surrender. Now, for a lot of us, when we're waiting for something important to happen or we're going through a difficult time, the reality is it is very challenging to reach that point. And many of us get to surrender on our knees when we have no other choice but to just let go and say the hell with it. You know, the old simple prayer. I shouldn't bring it up if I can't remember it. But, you know, I just remember one of my early spiritual mentors saying to me, you know, there's always the high-level prayer of something like the hell with it. Or, that's it. I give up.
That's a good cue to know if you're right there at the surrendering point.
Yeah, exactly. If you're feeling any angst at all, you haven't fully surrendered yet.
Mm.
And listen, learning to surrender takes a lot of practice. It's not a practice of the head. It's a practice of the heart, you know, where little by little, with the different events that occur in our life, we are challenged to just let go and trust. When we've done all we can, you let go and trust. What else can you do? You can't call the manager you interviewed with and force them to return your phone calls. That's never going to get you the job.
Right, right. Well, and then the flip of that is, you know, we do need to be sending out the resumes and showing up on the interviews and doing our part. Because one of the other sides I see is the just, oh, I'm just surrendering that, you know, that clients are going to show up in my life and money is going to just land in my mailbox.
And I understand it. Again, it's part of the spiritual path. But, yes, sometimes, you know, I do a radio show on Mondays, a call-in show, and people will call me and they'll say, you know, I'm trying to manifest my dreams and nothing's happening. And I surrender, but nothing happens. And I say to them, okay, well, what are you doing to manifest your dreams? Well, I'm surrendering.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. What else are you doing? Like, have you written down what those dreams are? Have you created some kind of an action plan? You know, like, what forward steps are you taking? I mean, I remember one time meeting with a very, very special spiritual teacher in my life who said a phrase to me that was, you know, and great, great spiritual teachers say so much in so few words. And I remember she said to me, she was telling me a story And at one point in the story, she said to me, she was talking about how she was going out to remedy this situation that she was having. And she said, so, you know, I decided to take action. And as you know, things just happen when you take action. Things just happen when you take action. And in the context of our conversation, what I heard her saying was, you know, grace is happening in our lives, but you've got to meet grace halfway. I mean, we've got to be energetically engaged in the world. We have to take action in order for the influence of grace. It's almost like in order to sort of stimulate the energy that gets things moving and happening, you can't just to sit down in the middle of your room and pray and say, okay, I'm surrendering right now, God, help me out. You know, please bring X into my life. It's simply, what that tells me is that there's just a need for more maturity in terms of your relationship with a higher power, because that's a childlike relationship with God that a lot of us grew up with, by the way. That childlike relationship of, okay, I'll be a good girl and then I'll get what I want, or I'll pray really hard and then I'll get what I want, or, you know, I'll just surrender here and wait for the burning bush to show up. It's a young spiritual perspective, and you know, a more mature way of growing that up is by taking more consistent action. You know, getting out and doing something yourself, doing your part.
I love that. Well, and you got it so perfectly described. I think we maybe all need to go refer to page number 141 in your book.
I know, I should, you know what, I'm going to look right now and make sure that's the page, because I do, I talk about that page a lot. I tell people, you know, if there's one page you're going to dog ear in that book, that's where it starts. Let me make sure it's 141. Yes, surrender to the music.
Yeah.
So page 141, that's definitely the place to. As a matter of fact, can I just read one quick thing, one point I want to make?
Oh, yeah.
I just want to say that, because this to me was profound, it was taught to me, and I use it every day of my life. I say here that our source of suffering is always related to our resistance to what is. The soul doesn't try to control life, the ego does. When your ego is wrapped firmly around a desire, your peace of mind and happiness are held hostage by an obsessive need to control the outcome. After enough pain and suffering, you'll eventually get the message. If you don't learn to surrender your will surrender your peace. It takes a leap of faith to abandon your way for the right way. It means letting go of how you think things should be and accepting them as they are. But when we surrender, it doesn't mean that we simply throw our hands in the air and do nothing at all. It means that we pay close attention to the messages we get from our divine partner so we can act on this wisdom. Then, once we've done what we can, we let go and allow the divine to take over to bring about the result that will serve our spiritual development. And that's, you know, that's a very, very important skill to learn. If you just practiced one skill, that would be the one to practice.
It's probably one of my favorite paragraphs in your whole book. I know that I reread that one at least a few times. I loved it so much. Well, and so let's shift to another big element in the unmistakable touch of grace. You talk about the link between science and silence and bringing in a bit of meditation. Tell us about that.
There's a whole chapter in the book about that. One of the things that's really fascinating to me is a lot of the new brain research that's being done. And one of the ways that we step into the flow, that we experience more grace in our life, that we actually create balance, interestingly enough, is through the practice of silence. And in the book, I talk a lot about very practical ways. I mean, people who know me and have read my books know that I'm a practical gal. I really believe, I don't want to just, you know, write a book that inspires people to feel good. I'm a coach, and I want to give you stuff that you can do to experience what I'm writing about. And
step by step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I write about specific ways to make the practice of silence more doable in one's life. And the reason for that is it really does a practice balancing silence with activity. It's interesting. One of my mentors said to me once, you know, Cheryl, all stress is an imbalance between silence and activity. And that's another very profound statement. Very true.
All stress is
an imbalance between silence and activity. The more you balance your activity in the world with silence, the more balanced you become. And interestingly enough, from a science perspective, you create something called brain synchrony. When we meditate, quiet, we slow the brainwave, our brain starts to make slower brainwave patterns, so we get more relaxed. We create something called brain synchrony, which means we actually synchronize both hemispheres of the brain, which puts you into a much more resourceful state for making choices and decisions. Most of us are operating heavy on the left side, which means the left hemisphere is functioning a lot more than the right, which is interesting when you think about it. Most of us feel out of balance. Literally, our brain is out of balance. So
wow.
Creating a practice of silence is it makes for good health. It's probably the best time management tool that we have, and it doesn't have to be an hour a day. You could start with 5 minutes a day. You could start with, I did a couple of years ago, I did a guided meditation CD that has a 10-minute meditation, a 20-minute meditation, and a 30-minute meditation, because I was too busy to do an hour, and 30 minutes felt like hell. 20 minutes felt like hell when I was really, you know, early on when my mind was just so busy. So I started with 10 minutes, and using some kind of a guided tool is a great way to train your mind to just calm down, to train yourself to kind of breathe and be centered. And so there is this dramatic link. I mean, I in the book I talk about how the brain operates, how the brain waves, you know, the different brain wave levels and what they do. And the interesting thing is when you teach people to meditate deeply, what deep meditators, long-term meditators, report in scientific studies is that in the deepest place of meditation, they feel something that I would label very spiritual, and that is a deep connection to all that is, a profound sense that everything is happening as it should. In other words, there's no attachment to any outcome. It doesn't mean that bad things don't happen in your life, but it means that you're no longer overshadowed by them. You're able to just deal with them. And meditation gives us an opportunity to develop a witnessing perspective. In other words, we're better able to observe how we operate in the world. And by when you can observe how you operate in the world, you can actually change your behavior much more easily. So there is a huge link between science and silence. We're going to see it more. One of the things we're seeing now that I think is very exciting is the new neurotechnology that's coming out where companies are using something called binaural beat technology. As a company, Holosync is a good example.
Uh-huh.
Binaural beat technology that literally you can put on headphones and listen to what sounds like rain in the background with just these chimes, and it will cause your brain to start making slower brainwave patterns. And this is where I think there's going to be a great intersection between science and spirituality, because we'll be able to use, I mean, think about what I said early on in this call, that our nervous systems are not designed to handle the load of technology and the pace of life that's occurred as a result. But now we're going to use technology to actually train the brain to slow down and get centered so that you can actually process more information, more stimuli, more emotional input in a much more balanced and effective way. And I think that's very exciting.
I think that's very exciting, too. With technology and email and, oh, my gosh, we are expected to do so much more. And it's really nice to know that, and inspiring to know that something as little as starting with 5 minutes a day of silence can start to shift those brainwaves. And as we all know, practice is everything. We start doing a little something here and build on that, and day by day by day, the compounded effect of that ends up really, really shifting the way we see the world.
I mean, I remember just learning that, you know, I get into the sort of brain science of it in the book, so I won't take up the time to do that now. But here's a cool thing just to know. Just when you close your eyes, your brain automatically starts making alpha brainwave patterns.
Really?
It's the same brainwave patterns that are being made when you're in that in-between state, when you're just falling to sleep, you know, that really beautiful, deeply relaxed state.
Mm-hmm.
Just by closing your eyes, you automatically force your brain to begin making those brainwave patterns. So, you know, when I first learned that, it really made for a great argument. I'll do it during the day. If I'm feeling overwhelmed with something, I'll often just stop and close my eyes because I know that all of a sudden my brain is now making slower brainwave patterns. It's going to calm me down, and I'm going to be in a much more resourceful place to make choices and decisions.
You know, I hadn't known that, but that's something I do sometimes between coaching appointments. If I've got a full day, 8-9 clients or something in between, I'll just, it's amazing what an impact.
Yep, it's a great thing to do.
Great to know that there's actually something scientific going on, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and let's move a little bit into your journey. as an author, speaker, coach. There are quite a few people that are coaches on the lines or therapists and professionals. And maybe just to talk a little bit about what initially contributed to your success as a coach.
Probably the primary thing that contributed to my success as a coach was two things. A deep commitment to, well, probably three things, probably a lot of things, but first of all, an insatiable curiosity about what makes human beings tick. I've always had it about myself, have had it about other people, still have it now. I find people fascinating. I love to learn about them. I love to hear what's going on with them. I feel like I've developed a strong intuitive gift to be able to see why people come here and what it is they're meant to do. I can just sort of look at a person and in talking with them, briefly begin to get a sense of that. It's not because I'm some great psychic. It's because I have a lot of experience under my belt, and I have this insatiable curiosity. That's number one. Number two, Thomas said to me early on, Cheryl, don't worry about how much money you're making, how many clients you have, how well-known you are. Just focus on being the best coach that you can be, and everything else will take care of itself. And he's right. I really wanted to master as well as I could the art of coaching, and that meant, you know, I had enrolled in Coach U. At that time, it was a 3-year coach training program. You could do a personal track, a business track, or a master track, which was the whole thing. I signed up for the whole ball of wax, took it seriously, dedicated, you know, at least 3 years to really, really know the material, to implement, to use it with my clients, and at the same time put an equal, if not more, amount of time and energy into getting my own life straightened out. That became a vital part of my training. Gave me a chance, you know, as I got myself out of debt and improved my finances and created a soul-nurturing environment, things like that, I was able to experience the emotional process of doing those things, which set me up to really support clients as well. So that would be number two. And number three, there was a third one, and I'm getting it. Hold on 1 second. It went right out the window. It'll come back.
Okay.
It's supposed to. But yeah, really being curious about people.
You said at the beginning, deep commitment?
Yeah, the third one was, I know what I did is I combined two and three. So two was really wanting to master coaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so please note that I didn't take a weekend workshop to become a coach. I want to just really say that I make that point a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot become a masterful coach in a weekend workshop or 6 months. You've got to really devote time and energy.
Right.
Earn skills, but you've really got to practice them over time. And I also was very fortunate to have a group of colleagues, you know, some of the people who started out early on as well, who I always credit as being very instrumental in my work as a coach. You know, we would get on the phone with each other. There were 10 or 12 of us every single week and coach each other and learn from each other. And that was vitally important. And the third thing was the point I made about investing in my own growth. That was really, really important that I was doing. Engaged. I had my own coach, and I was engaged in the same process that I was helping clients work through at the same time. That's,
I think that is foundation. So key. I mean, imagine if people were coaching and hadn't even transformed their own lives first.
Well, and let me just say that, you know, we're all a work in progress.
Right.
And so I want to just, you know, a lot of times I'll talk to new coaches who are brilliant, like naturally gifted, and they think they've got to be all fixed before they can work with people. No, that's not true. But you do have to be on a path, and you've got to be committed to your own growth, and you've got to be working on that. And, you know, there's an old saying, and I find this to be true, that your clients as a coach are usually one step ahead of you or one step behind you.
Yeah.
I used to joke with my husband, if I had a coaching week where, you know, five or six clients were talking about problems in their marriage,
yeah,
I would say to him that night, honey, is there something we need to talk about? Because usually we draw to us people who are either just going through what we just went through or are going through what we're about to go through. So it's another important reason why doing your own work is so critical.
I found that to happen over and over, and it's amazing the number of clients that will be experiencing the same problem in the same week.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's
very true.
Quite amazing. Well, so who do you think should work with a coach? It's obviously, and you've been one of the probably biggest catalysts, is just raising awareness about the industry of coaching. But who do you really see is who should be working with a coach?
I think people who want to work with a coach.
Mm-hmm.
I never you know, a lot of times people in the media will say, you know, who really needs a coach? Or, you know, why should I need you? And I don't even go there. It's like,
yeah,
you know, there has to be a strong desire. Somebody who has very specific things they want to accomplish in their life, who's tired of doing it alone, especially smart people who are so used to supporting other people that, you know, they're so used to giving to everyone else. And on some level, whether they admit it or not, they think that, you know, there's nobody out there smart enough to work with them. Those are people that really need a coach, really would benefit from working with a coach. So somebody who's got very specific goals in mind, really wants the support of a partner, is ready to make the commitment, can afford it, can easily afford it. You know, those are the people that really benefit from having a coach. People who are really committed to taking action, because if you're not ready to take action consistently, you're going to waste your time and money, and you're going to waste the coach's time as well. So it could be a business owner, could be a corporate employee, could be an artist, you know, a creative type, somebody who wants to change careers or really wants to just do the personal foundation work like we talk about in terms of dealing with finances or clutter or things like that. But somebody who's really, really committed to making changes and open-minded, you know, open to hearing what somebody else has to say.
I would completely agree. That's where it all starts, with a sense of commitment, because where there is willingness, there comes momentum. Yeah. Well, and so you've progressed now with all the books that you've done and, gosh, 4 books and all the media stuff. You know, what's really been the key for you getting really good at what you're doing? Because that's another thing. A lot of people are getting out there with books and so forth, and so addressing the media, how do you get good at it?
Do it a lot. You just do it. It's sort of like, how do you get good at coaching? By coaching a lot of people, by making a lot of mistakes. Now, certainly with media and with getting out in the public eye, you know, one of the things that we published last October was the Practice Building Workshop. It's a comprehensive audio program. And in there, I did 2 CDs of a talk that I gave, an intimate gathering with a bunch of coaches about the writing process, building a speaking career, and dealing with the media. And I talked very specifically about what it takes, because, yes, it takes a lot of practice, and that's important, but there are other very specific things that need to be taken into account. There are common mistakes people make, for example, that will very often get in the way of them building maybe a more public career. And I'll give you some examples of some of the things that I talk about in that program. And, you know, things like looking at image. I would have never, ever been able to do the Oprah series, let alone some of the higher-end corporate events that I've done, had I not hired an image consultant to help me bring a more authentic me to my physical presence, my physical image. You know, when I started out in business speaking, I used to wear my Little House on the Prairie dresses, and I had long, curly hair, and it just wasn't professional. It wasn't the best reflection of me as a professional woman. And, you know, it's one of those things very few people do. I had a lot of resistance to it in the beginning. As a matter of fact, I had worked with an image consultant, one consultant at first, who was not very good and tried to make me into somebody else, so it really added to my resistance. I tend to be a rebel at heart, and I thought, no one's going to tell me how to dress.
Right, right.
But I actually met a wonderful woman, a woman I talk about a lot. Her name's Ginger Burr, and I met her in an event I was speaking at. She actually called me to hire me as a coach, and I remember meeting her and thinking, she looks so well put together. Her stationery was beautiful. Her language was, you know, she was just a beautiful person and so congruent in terms of how she looked, how she behaved on the inside, how she looked on the outside. And I hired her, and in a very loving and practical way, she helped me to begin to build a professional image and to evolve that image over time, so that she worked with me when I was doing the Oprah show early on. You know, sometimes we would shop together to get the right clothes because, honey, if it was up to me, I would have, like, shown up in jeans and a T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, no. I mean, I probably wouldn't have done that for Oprah, but, you know, she really helped me to put together a professional image.
Wow.
A very vital part that often gets overlooked. Or, here's another great mistake that people make. People have really not good pictures taken of themselves, and they put them on their websites or on their products. Like, I, as a very well-known coach, I received a piece of mail from this coach about 3 months ago. Now, this coach is an exceptionally good coach, somebody who I think is brilliant at what they do. And I got this thing in the mail, and there was a photograph of the coach on this brochure, this newsletter. And it was not a good photograph. The coach looked angry. And I thought, oh, what a shame that somebody smart didn't see this photo before it went on here, because it's not a media-savvy photo. It's not, you know, there's a lot of time and attention that goes into things like that so that you're able to put your best foot forward. And those are simple little things. They seem simple. They get overlooked. And, I mean, think about it. From now, everyone listening to this call, the next time you receive a piece of mail that has someone's photograph, look at it and ask yourself, how do you feel about that photograph? Or when you visit a website and you look at someone's photograph, I don't know about all of you, but if I'm checking out somebody new for maybe a product we're looking at or a service we need, I always go to the bio page and I always look at the photograph. How approachable is that person? How professional is the photograph without it looking staged? That's a really important part. So there were all different components, and image and photographs are just one piece of it. Having the right support people in place, professionals who know the things that you don't know, that help you to build a public image. Certainly, what has contributed greatly to my public success is my relationship building skills. I'm really good at building relationships because I care about people. And I put relationships before results. I can tell you there are people in the media that I offered free coaching to and supported for no reason whatsoever, but because I felt like the universe put that person in front of me at a time where they needed me. And without an agenda of ever doing anything, I would support them, and a year later I'd have them call me to do some television show or to do some magazine article because I cared about who they were. I put the authentic soul work before the personality work or the personality desire, let's say. And so the whole communication skills, relationship building piece is extremely important.
Well, this is such a great example of how you've really taken action and you've done all of your part. And then from there, obviously, there's grace continues to guide you and along your path, but that path probably would be a lot less different or maybe a lot less successful had you not taken each one of these pieces and really...
Yeah, I mean, one of the real challenges, you know, in doing the Oprah show, it's very easy in our culture in particular here in the States to see someone like on the Oprah Winfrey show and think of them as an overnight success. But, you know, I'm very blessed with the success that I've experienced, and I have busted my butt to get here. There were no easy, quick, you know, paths to the success that I've experienced. For example, I gave 200 free speeches before I ever got paid for my first speech. Nobody knows that, but that's part of how I developed my speaking ability. I did hundreds of free interviews, whether it was on radio, newspaper, or television, before I ever did the Oprah show, probably 1,000. So you've got to really be willing to pay your dues. And, you know, interestingly enough, the group of people who are willing to do that is a small group. But when you do, when you're willing to do what it takes and to work really, you know, diligently and committed, and when you, and this is important, as you grow up, you recognize that you need to make service, being of service, your primary motivation. And that can't come from a head personality place. It needs to come from a soul place. And that only happens over time as we grow up. When you make service your primary motivation, when you really connect with what it is you want for people and you commit to giving them whatever they need in order to get that, that's when grace really, you know, you really feel the influence of grace in your life as well. Because it's not about you, and it's not about the success you experience. You know, I would have never, ever been offered a whole series on Oprah had I not been a woman who was deeply committed to changing people's lives, because she knew it. She was checking me out from the beginning. I could tell that. You know, was I coming from a place of ego and just wanting to be a star, or did I deeply care about people? And by the time I got to her, I was able to sort of get over that hump of wanting to be a star, and I deeply cared about people, and that's what I know made her say, let's bring this woman's work to the world. So that all comes from a commitment to our own personal growth, which is what I strongly encourage everyone to do, to make that commitment.
Well, and so now that you've created so much momentum in your own life, how is it that you maintain a sense of balance? And then continuing to write books, speak, travel. How do you manage it all?
Well, Right now, you know, it's interesting. I get asked that question a lot because people think I have a really crazy life. I have a pretty busy life right now because my husband and I are just finishing building a home.
Congratulations. That's a busy one.
That's a huge thing while trying to run a company. I have really good people who work for me. That makes a huge difference. I am extremely organized. And the truth is, I say no to about 80% of all the invitations that come my way. Especially in the last year, I've really pulled back from traveling. I'll continue to do that for the next year. I'm going to start working on my fifth book. The truth is right now I have a lot going on, so I can't even honestly say to you, things are pretty balanced. They normally are, but because of the house,
I have
to be unbalanced until October. But again, remember what I said earlier? It's like I have the ability to focus my time and attention in the place that I want to, have a little bit more going on than I wish I did, but that's just the nature of things, and by October things will be a lot calmer, please God.
That's right. It's prioritization. My father is just finishing building his house, so do I understand that one.
Yeah, it's a big project. But, you know, having really good people working for you, learning how to delegate, not trying to hoard everything yourself or believing that you're the only one that can do it, and being organized, being willing to pass up good for great, it's a phrase I try and live by whenever I'm faced with an opportunity. Time and again, when I've said yes to something that was like a okay or maybe, I've regretted it afterwards. Having high standards, it's all about extreme self-care.
Really trusting yourself. Well, what do you do when you start to feel overwhelmed or do you ever go to that place of feeling stressed?
Oh, never.
No?
No, I'm always stress-free.
That's what we thought. You know, you're the expert on this.
No. Listen, an expert just means you're willing to admit that you don't know.
Yeah.
You're willing to admit that you're willing to admit when you make mistakes or when you can't do something. I mean, but what I do is I definitely turn to the practice of silence. That's one of the priorities that's deeply important to me and helps to rejuvenate me. And getting out into nature for me is what really does it. You know, going to the beach, or we have a beautiful state park right near my home that I go down to. And looking at stopping and saying, okay, who can I get to help me and what can I take off my plate? Those two things are really important as well.
Great question. Love that one. Well, and so with everything that you've accomplished, the Oprah series and best-selling books and PBS specials and your web community, what is the accomplishment that you're most proud of?
Let's see, I'm going to say the first things that come to mind instead of, like, trying to think about it and give you, like, the appropriate answer.
Okay, good. We don't want the appropriate one.
I'm very proud of having published books because I'm a writer at heart. It meant a lot to me to, the first time, take time ever get on the New York Times list as a writer. I was really proud of that accomplishment. I don't know why, I just want to, the other thing that, probably the first thing that popped into my head is I'm really proud of my marriage. You know, I have a wonderful relationship with a great man, and I wouldn't be where I am today without him. And it takes a lot of work to make a marriage good, and I'm proud of my commitment to that and to both of our commitments to that. And I'm proud of my ongoing commitment to grow and evolve as a spiritual being. I think that's really important. And I think for me the greatest gift of having written a book or having put my own experience into a book is that, you know, if I died tomorrow, I would die feeling like I've really contributed something important to the world, that somehow my own personal work evolved into a way of putting what I've learned in writing so that it can stay here beyond me when I leave. And I'm proud of that. I feel good about that. And, I mean, those are the things that come to mind.
Those are big ones. When I remember you saying about, in one of your books, about referring to Michael as your rock and source of strength. But interesting, because that's something that sort of really stayed with me. And my own John, who I just married, has sort of become the same thing. I think I was sort of looking for that same quality running in the background. Really important. Well, we're
kind of bumping up against our time here, so maybe this is a good time just to announce our three prize winners and what they will get to take away, and then just any final comments that you want to add. So our three prize winners, I'm very excited to announce. First one is Gloria Auth, A-U-T-H. It's Gloria at protoquopus.net. Grace Moore, pretty synchronistic that a Grace would win one of the
games.
Can you believe that? Grace becomes her at Comcast.net. And Kristen Tolliver, KTCoaching at AOL.com. And she is an amazing, brilliant coach. I actually happen to know her, but it was not rigged. So those are our three prize winners. And what we'll be sending out from the Cheryl Camp will be the Unmistakable Touch of Grace and then the audio CDs. You want to say a bit about those?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was just going to say, let's make sure one of the things we do on the website is when people order books, I do personally sign all of them, but I also write a little private note, like an individual note. So I want to make sure I do that for the three winners.
Oh, great. Okay.
So when you send their information over, I'll be sure to do that. And the Grace CD is something that just came out last month. It's a 6-CD program of there was not a read version of The Unmistakable Touch of Grace done in CD, and this one is a workshop that I did, you know, a very practical workshop about how to see and experience the power of grace in your life. So that just came out, and that'll be coming along with the book. And all of those things, including the practice building workshop and all that stuff, are in our online store at myextremeselfcare.com or right at CherylRichardson.com.
And I so recommend people going and visiting the community. I've actually coached people that were part of your community, and they were saying just what an impact that interacting with other people and people that are
We have great, great people. It's really a wonderful place. And also, you know, I guess the final thing I just want to say is we've got this really cool feature on the website called A Touch of Grace, and you'll see it right on the homepage at CherylRichardson.com. I won't tell you what it is because it's a surprise, but it's a great way to get a touch of grace every day, so visit that as well.
Oh, very nice surprise. Wonderful. Well, Cheryl, I am just so, so pleased to have had this opportunity and be one of the 20% of the invitations that you happen to accept. And I know all of our listeners are just so grateful right now to you and for all the wisdom that you've shared on our call today. And I think you will have created the ripple effect once again with hundreds of people that are listening in. So I thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary Cole. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I still got to get used to that.
No, you'll get used to it
right away. Well, I'll just open up the lines. And any final words? Any final words, Cheryl?
Just, you know, God bless you all. That's really my final words. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Conversations with the Masters with your host, Mary Allen. If you would like to participate in upcoming live conference call interviews, visit www.lifecoachmary.com. Transcripts and audio of previous interviews with such masters as Wayne Dyer, Carolyn Mace, Debbie Ford, Byron Katie, and others are available on iTunes or at www.lifecoachmary.com. For more information on the work of Mary Allen, her upcoming Success and Inner Peace Boot Camp, or to sign up for her free online newsletter, Soulfully Living, and to receive inspiring daily quotes, visit lifecoachmary.com. Thank you for being committed to your own personal and spiritual development, and thank you for spreading the word about the Conversations with the Masters series. We wish you a fabulous day.